Rockstar Podcast, episode 150. We talk about sleep, CPAP machines. Are you getting up early? Are you getting up late? Competition. Do you steal it? I don't know. And Mariano has a whole digestive system thing that he's going to figure out for the next episode, as Aggie and Mariano have a secondary podcast after I stopped recording. Hope you enjoy this one. Bye, guys. Hello, and welcome to Rockstar Podcast. Nobody knows but me remembers episode number 150.
Whoa.
That is amazing.
Party
I feel
time.
Like you have to have a party.
Not as amazing as the night that Gina will have tonight, but it won't matter because she won't hear this until next week.
If at all.
No, she does listen.
She does listen.
Yes. So it's really good that you got tickets for Hamilton. Congratulations. And then
it's not Hamilton, but sorry, honey.
Tell us a little bit about what you're doing.
Oh, geez. I didn't know this was going to be on the podcast. Okay, so I occasionally like to surprise my wife with nights out. And I'm going to be taking her to dinner and a show tonight. The kids are sleeping over with my mother-in-law. And we're meeting a couple friends for the whole thing. So
He's crushing spousaldom, which I don't think is a word, but it just became one.
It's an Aggieism.
I paid attention to one factor. The kids are sleeping over at the mother-in-law's house. That's all I paid attention to.
Nice work.
Yeah, it's amazing what guys will do for stuff. Yes, Aggie, how are you?
I'm doing really well. How are you, Lorenzo?
Your crisp voice is fantastic.
Thanks, guys.
Mariano at episode 150 is feeling stressed all of a sudden, apparently.
Well, now I feel like I need to talk into the microphone and elevate my voice. I have to elevate my game.
We're sitting in a different spot than we normally. This is our new spot, and the chairs in this room are lower to the ground. For those that don't know me, I'm quite low to the ground. So my feet actually hit the ground. So I think that my face is now in the mic, which is why it sounds so good. I'm 7 feet tall. You didn't know that?
You're 7 feet tall with attitude. How tall are you just in general?
Okay, so my doctor and I negotiated. I'm 5'1".
I negotiated with
my doctor. I'm 5 foot and a little bit. So I looked at my doctor and I said, so 5'1", right? And he kind of went, all right, I'll give it to you. So 5'1".
I think it's adorable, 5 foot and a little bit. I do.
So, but that word you just used to describe it is why I don't say that.
Yes.
Oh. It's adorable.
No.
She's being very proactive here because because a guy would never say 6 foot and a little bit. But I never would. I'm 6'1".
No, I would.
How tall are you?
I'm about 5'11".
5'11". Yeah. Okay. Stunning shirt today.
I am rocking the pink shirt.
It's awesome.
You think I'm coming from a negative point. I wear a pink shirt. I have a salmon shirt. I have a taupe shirt. I have many shirts. yesterday, I sent my kid to school for sprinkler day.
Uh-huh. Mm.
And my lovely, her lovely teacher, Miss Laura, who has been her teacher for since she's been an infant, basically, texted me and said, underwear? I said, well.
Oops.
Bathing suit bottom? And we rocked it. Yes. So
it's just sometimes you just have to MacGyver parenting.
Yeah,
that's
said, you got paper towels? I don't know. Socks on her legs? I don't know. Just
a
figure
fig
it
leaf.
Out.
I'll take a fig leaf.
So she is extremely dramatic with any kind of blemish of scrape from falling or anything all her life.
Really?
And yes, but 2 weeks ago, she got turf burn, basically, which is, you know, from the school she fell.
Mm-hmm.
And that stuff burns.
Yeah.
Not a shed of tear, not nothing. Then it turned into this huge scrape on her elbow. And all I keep telling her is, in 6 years, this is the proudest moment I've ever had, that you're not crying, you're not upset about it. But she is obsessing about the fact, because she's proud of it, of how every day, like a centimeter of it is going away, and she's washing it every day because Nonna said you'll get infected. The crazy talk thing. And you just, the smallest things in my house, I walk around my house, I swear to God, and I say, this is insanity house. I have one kid, and the house is insanity. It's because my mother was there.
Or singing,
my wife,
singing on the microwave.
That was a beautiful moment.
Oh, yeah. Everyone needs to follow Lorenzo on Instagram to see that video.
I think I put it in my story.
Oh, well, you have to repost. Put it in highlights.
I think I have to put it in there. Yes. There was a microwave in the living room. My daughter sat on it.
As you do.
Singing. Yeah. I mean,
and she's
saying, where do you keep your
microwave? She's singing beautifully.
The entertaining part is, until about 4 months ago, she would sing and then start laughing and saying, I'm a terrible singer. It's good. It's good. She needs to know that she's a terrible singer. She is a terrible singer. But now she's gotten better. So I like the
progression.
Progression, but self-awareness of it.
Right. And she's practicing, which is pretty
cool.
She's
having fun with it. Like she, yes. I mean, look, I'm not going to, you know, see Simon Cowell anytime soon, but I'm crossing my fingers. One day, I'm getting tired of this crap, especially with you people not retweeting this podcast. Thank you, by the way, Aggie and Mariana, for retweeting it.
Always.
Do we have? Do you have your laptop today, Mariano?
Yes, I have my. I did research on some stuff.
Wow.
What is that? What is that? Is that a?
This is an iPad.
It is. Oh, okay.
It's that's an iPad with it's an a iPad keyboard, right?
Yeah. It looks like the attachment. A failed attempt at a '90s laptop, but now I realize. Well, because it looks not like aesthetically typically like an
Apple. Yeah. No, that's what it essentially is.
Aggie, what did you bring to the table today?
I actually have a topic that I wanted to talk about. That is not an article. It's something that my friend tweeted, as we're talking about Twitter, that I think is a really great topic.
Okay.
Are you coming off of a binger of a night last night in Keyport, or no?
No. Okay. I just went to dinner with my friend in Keyport. We walked around and then put
Where'd
the kids to sleep.
Old Glory
in Keyport is a great pizza place. If you're local, you should go.
Okay. The former Trinity, for those of you who are old school.
Yes.
Okay. Mariana?
Yeah, you Aggie? Go. No, you go.
Oh, you want me to go?
Yeah.
There's multiple topics there.
No, actually, it's one topic, but I did a little research on it, too.
Wow.
So I came prepared. So the reason why this came up, this is all about sleep and not getting enough sleep. So one of the evenings this week, I've adjusted my sleep habits since we started the podcast. It used to be I didn't get enough sleep at all, ever. But as I'm getting older, I'm finding I'm not as effective when I don't get enough sleep. And this week I was reminded of it because I worked into the night till about 3 a.m. And the next day my mind was very mushy. So I wanted to do a little bit of research on it. And, you know, I know that you are of the same ilk as I am, Lorenzo.
I've gotten better, but...
Right, but the you know I wanted to pose the topic here to discuss, but just a few tidbits that I did in my research. If you're not getting at least, according to WebMD, if you're not getting at least 7 hours of sleep, you may not be at your best. It affects your attention and concentration, your reaction time, decision making, less likely to be creative in memory. So, I wanted to know.
That was Aggie, by the way, everybody. So it's not me this time.
Sorry, everyone.
Mine is silent.
Failing.
It's because you're talking, probably.
So I wanted to know what you guys, what your sleep habits are like. Talk about it and what you feel like when you don't get enough sleep. What is enough sleep for you? So
this is important. I'm glad we're talking about this topic. This ties in really nicely with something that I wanted to bring up. So this is great.
Just great. Don't tell me you're going to talk about breakfast or something like that. It'll be all thrown off.
We'll talk about vegan oats later. So I have always been someone who has required a lot of sleep. Like prior to kids, I definitely needed my 8 hours a night. And then kids happened, and it was like they changed my whole everything because suddenly I was waking up every few hours to feed babies, and now I don't do that anymore because my kids are older, and I still have trouble just sleeping through the night. Mm-hmm. So I've been trying to get to bed earlier, which I'm not always successful with because I know that as someone who is working in an office, comes home and parents, and then, you know, when everyone's asleep in the house, that's my time to actually have my alone time, watch a show, just browse the internet. And you kind of have to sacrifice that to get to bed earlier. And so it's never easy for me, but when I do, I feel great the next day because I usually get to bed a lot earlier.
What's earlier?
If I can get to bed by 9 p.m.
That
would be fantastic.
I can't even comprehend.
But the reason being this. No. But the reason being this. I like to run. And if I can go to bed by 9 p.m. and then wake up by like 5 a.m., 6 a.m., I can run, get ready for work, and be out the door and be like in the best headspace ever. Now, in reality, on the day-to-day, I really don't get to bed at that time. But that's my goal.
So it's macro hope.
Hope.
But reality is 10, 15.
11 p.m. usually 11. Is like when. And then I don't feel so good the next day. And I don't feel like running.
So you're getting up at what, 6-ish usually?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 5 a.m. if I want to run. 6 a.m. if it's just, you know, normal day.
Understood. I want to stop the shaming of people who go to sleep late because...
There's no shame.
No. There's the reverse psychology shaming by saying the early bird gets the worm. Mm-hmm. And I'm saying if you're, let me see, it always gets pitched as, there was a phrase I saw it. If getting up early means you're not lazy, then why does going to sleep early mean you're not lazy? Mm-hmm. And it's just, but I've never subscribed to that logic of getting up at 5 a.m. with respect. Because I don't think anything happens at 5 a.m. I know you're running, but mm-hmm. in general, right. Because I think if you're going to bed at 10, you're losing out. So it's always just been a silly thing for me to hear about, like, you know, getting up early versus going to sleep late or whatever. I need 6 hours, and mm-hmm. I need 6 hours ever since I started the CPAP machine. Because if I slept 6 hours anyway, the 6 hours that I slept prior to the CPAP machine it's a different world for me. So it's been 2 years. But I'm sleeping. I go to sleep at around 1 a.m.
Can you expand on the CPAP machine?
Yeah. well, I go to bed around usually. Last night I went to bed at 2. But usually I go to bed around 1, and I usually get up at 8. So I get a good 7 hours.
Okay.
CPAP machine. I tried the machine 5 years ago by having someone come and put all the stuff on me, which was entertaining in itself. If you remember the movie, there's the movie Roger Rabbit back in the day.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
The rabbit woman, she was very pear-shaped, womanly. Okay, Jessica Rabbit, yes. Thank you. So that's basically who showed up in my house at 9 o'clock at night to tuck me into bed and put cables on me while my wife sat at the foot of the bed. So that was fantastically awkward. I slept with it, not the rabbit. The machine. So I did the machine, and they gave me the results, but I already knew they were going to be bad. Fast forward 5 years later, I didn't continue with getting a CPAP machine from the first experience. Fast forward 5 years later, I went to a sleep study place and slept over because the amount of, it's almost like a small stress level test because the cables that were attached to me when I slept at home were 7 of them or 8 of them. And when I slept at the place, there were 62 of them.
Wow.
So it was from everywhere. And basically get there, and it looks like a luxury small hotel room, cable, the whole thing. I sleep without the machine. They just have the stuff on me. And then they check the status, and at any point that they feel like it's time that you do need the machine, they do that. So I fell asleep at 11. They woke me up at 12:30, and I put the machine on me. Basically, my data was, the average person needs 95% oxygen level when they're sleeping. I was getting 82%, and now I'm up to 97% with the machine. The apneas, which is considered up to 11 seconds of not breathing. The average person has 4 in a night. I was doing about 90 of them. So almost 2 hours of my sleep was not breathing. Then now with the machine, I only have 3 on average per night. So the biggest change, obviously, I'm sure health indicators that I don't, you know, just tangible stuff, but the biggest changes I notice, I am not tired at all 3, 4, 5, 6 o'clock in the afternoon. Never.
That's great.
So I'm just not tired during the day at all. And I've noticed that my body has changed because if I go 1 or 2 nights without the machine, my body's okay. I'm fine. But after like the 3rd night, I noticed I start to crash in the afternoon.
Is it a big machine? Do you have to take it with you on vacation? It's about the size of a laptop. Stuff?
Yeah, but it travels free. It's like a car seat. So it's free because it's a medical device. And it sits right next to my, where I sleep. The tube, the thing, I never have a problem sleeping with it or anything like that. That's 2 years now. Yes.
So how much sleep is enough sleep for you guys then?
Eight would be fantastic, but I don't usually.
Are you one of those that can sleep, if you could, till like 11 o'clock in the morning?
So, no. Actually, I wish that I could. I usually have to use some sort of like a supplement or like a homeopathic remedy to sleep that long. I know you're laughing at me, but that's the truth.
I wasn't going to, but you started smirking at me.
I know. Well, because I was thinking about, now that I'm thinking about, what do I do to get good sleep? Because it is also me, but I'm trying to get my kids to get good sleep. And my kids do need a lot of sleep, and they just are not the best at going to bed. And I use magnesium and melatonin are usually the supplements that I'll use for myself. And you could do a very, very small amount for children. Consult your pediatrician.
Do you have a problem falling asleep? Does it take you a while?
Not anymore. It used to prior to kids. Now I think I'm just so exhausted. But then I use essential oils at night and I like swear by them.
Okay.
Lavender is like our necessary thing.
My mother-in-law uses a lot of those things for that kind of stuff.
It's necessary.
My wife just sleeps like she slept through Hurricane Sandy.
Oh, that's great.
Garrett just sleeps like a rock.
So I think I'll probably sleep sounder than my husband. Peter wakes up multiple times in the night, but he doesn't require as much sleep. He just never has, even as a kid. A few hours a night and he's good.
Does he snore?
Sorry, honey. Yes.
Yeah. Well, I say that because it's actually a statistic that over 60% of men do need a lot of apneas, unhealthy, which is why the CPAP machine, and I know this because I went through it, but there's actually a lot of people, if you hear any kind of nasal, like I sound like Ray Romano sometimes. But that's because I have a deviated septum, broken nose.
Yeah.
Mariano, you and I used to text randomly till 2 o'clock in the morning about work-related stuff for many, many years.
Yes.
I do it once in a while, but I don't get responses now. You were taking walks, though.
I do take walks. I generally...
like nighttime walks? What do you mean?
Walks.
Oh.
Yeah.
So in the woods. He listens to the Bell podcast, actually.
I listen to my podcast and take, you know, 20 to 40-minute walks.
That's great.
Before I go to sleep at night. I just find it's a good way for me to wind down, and very often I'll be listening to the conversations, and I'll have, you know, it'll allow me to go through my day and think about how those things relate to the way I operate during the day. And I shoot to get in bed by somewhere between 11 and 12. I'm not always successful, especially if I'm sucked down the distraction hole, the internet distraction hole. But I'm trying to be better about just turning off all my devices. I have, you know, my bedtime app running for my phone so that I know it kind of pops up an alert to make sure that I get 7 hours of sleep. And then, you know, I shoot to be up by 6:37 in the morning, generally. Well, 6:30 between 6:30 and eight in the morning.
That's nice.
More often between 7 and 8, but so, and I do find that when I'm not sleeping well, first of all, I have a shorter temper with my kids.
Mm-hmm.
Like not that I'm terrible, but I find that I get
more cranky
quickly. I also do find, like, there's a lot of things that I was reading about this, and I do find, like, I'm not so sure about the reaction time, but definitely my attention and concentration are down.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that I'm less able to be forward thinking about things. My logic, I take longer to get to a logical conclusion than I would if I'm sleeping enough.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, those are the things that I know sleep is good for me at least. And, you know, I kind of fall in line with a lot of the research that I was doing.
So you take a walk before bed?
Yes.
And that helps you feel tired?
It just helps me wind down. It's
interesting.
Because sometimes I'm going to bed and I'm stressed, and going for a walk just kind of lets me think through a lot of things. I kind of decide what I'm going to be doing the next day and that kind of thing. So that's
almost
that's where
meditative.
The walk helps me. And that's why it's not a high intensity walk. I'm not like,
okay.
You know, I'm more.
It's a podcast, but we understand what you did.
He just did the power walk motion.
Yes, the power walk motion.
So you've blown away by his late night walks.
Yeah.
You've probably blown away by your 5 a.m. walk.
Well,
I'm blown away by both of them, by the way. I just let you both know. But,
sorry to continue that. The funny thing is that a few years ago, when I was training for a 75-mile bike ride, I used to get up at 5 in the morning and go for 12, 15, 20-mile ride.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it difficult to do that now.
To be clear, I don't run at 5 a.m. because I enjoy the morning or think that that's like the best time.
It's
because, it's the time
right.
that it kind of fits in my schedule. If I don't run in the morning, sometimes I do have to run at night, and I find I have a really tough time falling asleep because of the endorphin rush.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I was asking about you're able to fall asleep after you exercise.
Right.
Because I can't. I'll go running at 9 p.m. and then I'll be up for hours.
At our age, you don't have endorphins after you run. You don't have to worry about that. By the way, just as a complete, because we're transparent, I'm looking at you now. You need to put the microphone in front of your mouth like we do, because you do this, and then you start looking at her.
Oh.
So take the laptop away. We're going to, this is, a, or just put it like, to, yes, to the side. The microphone.
Poor Mariano is getting like, just, you
well,
know.
I mean, we're at episode 150. It's been 12 years. I got to tell him sometime.
That's funny. Ooh, chair.
Okay, yes. Sorry.
That's okay. I
no,
love you.
No, because I see you doing this.
I love you. No, you're right.
I want people to know you're on the podcast. Because otherwise people hear it's nothing for a couple seconds. Thank you. Continue.
I was just listening to a podcast the other day. So shout out to Inside the Ice House, which my husband is the executive producer of. But Cindy Gallup was on one of their most recent episodes. And she is well known in the advertising and business industry. She's just a force to be reckoned with. And she was talking about how it's so important to do less and to sleep more, to do more. That in order, she has done some spectacular work in her life and continues to. And she said that she very often just does nothing because she needs to have that break and how sleep plays a huge role in that. Mm-hmm. I just kind of assumed that people of her caliber never slept. So it was so good to hear that. And that actually is like a huge inspiration to me to get to bed earlier because I think I want to be like that.
I used to fall victim to this, and meaning that we're obsessed, not us three, but just in general, we're obsessed with sleep. The only part of sleep that I care about and have cared about probably since the CPAP machine, because I understand it, is am I getting enough? Like, I don't care about anything else. And the reason is because I think as society, we always talk about get enough sleep. But nobody, and this is to your point, very rarely talks about not the fact of when of how much you sleep, but what you're doing when you're not sleeping, right? So walking around the building and stuff here like that, I know we all fall to it, but if you really looked at the hours that you spend in front of your computer versus how much of it is actually work, most people could probably have five-hour workdays if they worked for 5 hours straight.
That's true.
Right.
So the sleep with productivity, to me, it's sort of... doesn't mean anything because you could sleep 10 hours and I could sleep 4 or 6 hours, let's say, but your day is more productive even though you have less hours to work because you're working more effectively than I am.
Right.
So that's why I guess into the early bird gets the worm, blah, blah, blah. And I'm like, dude, but you're going to the gym. You're not getting any worms. You're working on legs, bro.
Yeah.
Right. Well, like it's not
leg day.
It's yeah, right. And I think, you know, this is interesting because I think we've been as a culture bred to understand that sleep is less important than it actually is. And we're only now starting to understand what the importance of it is. Thomas Edison used to harp on people that slept a lot and said that they were less intelligent. And he famously said, I only get 4 to 5 hours of sleep per night.
Right.
But he used to nap throughout the day.
Yes.
And had napping cots set up in his lab, had in his library. So, you know, like...
Let's do that. That's great.
His thing was...
Chair is good.
If I feel tired, I'm going to sleep. And I think that's the kind of thing that we have to remember is that, you know, our body needs the sleep for the concentration. So like you said... Somebody getting 10 hours sleep, yeah, maybe they're not working, quote unquote, as much.
Or whatever it is that you're doing.
But they're much more efficient at the work that they are doing.
So I have a question. Do you keep a notebook or something that you can write on next to your bed for when you come up with ideas?
I should, but I don't.
The reason that I ask is that even though I think...
This is so foreign to me. Like, I know what happens, but
yeah,
like...
Yeah, I sometimes come up with some really great ideas when I am tired and not quite asleep or if I wake up from a dream and I think of something. And that usually is important to me. I will write it down.
Well, you old people, I use the audio app on the iPhone. Us kids, that's what we do here. It's cool you guys got notebooks and shit. You got candlelight next to you. See, the thing is, Edison, when he said that, the problem was is that the reason why people slept so much was because there was no light, because he didn't invent anything.
Yes, that's true. Yes.
Like, you had to...
Well, the other statistic I read related to him is that people sleep an average of 1 to 2 hours less since the invention of the light bulb.
Say that again? Sorry.
People sleep an average of 1 to 2 hours less since the invention of the light bulb.
And 6 less since the internet.
Probably.
Right?
Probably. But my body starts shutting down at nighttime when it's dark out. Like, I will maybe want to mentally stay awake, but I just can't.
You know you can. It's just it's muscle memory. Like, this cup of coffee here, I will have this at 10 o'clock tonight.
And you can fall asleep?
I could fall asleep, I mean, within reason, but I'm doing that because I know I'm going to work till around 1-ish.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's every single night. Hmm. And I recently thought that I should change it from coffee to whiskey or bourbon. No, seriously, because...
medicinal purposes.
Yes. Right. Or other medicinal products. You know, hypothetically.
Tea.
What?
Sorry? Kind of.
What?
Tea.
Should we... Oh. Not really. But, well, yes. Okay. If you can smoke it. That said... I think whenever people sleep, it's good. It's what they do when they're awake. Right?
I have no idea what to even say to that.
Well, yes, we know what we're talking about. Aggie, your topic, please.
What, are we moving on already?
Yeah, no, I'm going to fall asleep.
You're going to fall asleep, really? Okay.
Well, we've talked sleep to death.
Well, this isn't sleep. This is actually has to do with productivity. So maybe this is the opposite of that. So I love Twitter, and I have a lot of friends on Twitter who are really better at Twitter than I am. So my friend Matt Kobach, shout out to Matt, who's their head of social at the New York Stock Exchange. He tweets a lot about social content and creating content that is valuable. And he tweeted today, everyone steals content ideas. Just don't steal them from your competitors. Steal them from different industries so that you stand out from your competition. I thought that was really interesting, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on this, given that all of us work in a space where we do create content. What
steal,
do you think about
steal,
that?
Do it, take it, everything. Every song, every musician, everything is stolen. And it's not always twisted into their own piece. Yes, I have so many of my designs that I've seen stolen. Have at it. I could care less. But yes, in general, that's my thought process. But what's the deeper part of it, Mariana? Because you look like you're in like the thinking man.
I don't know. I know. I'm trying to think about it in relation to the way we operate. I mean, well, first of all, in terms of content, you know, most of the time when we're creating content for customers, from a specific request, we will put it through a tool that we have to make sure that it isn't copied from somewhere else. Most of the time we're generating original content for that. And I think that's sometimes important because you're trying to tell a customer's story very often. And those stories are usually
unique. Stories individual, yes. But I'm saying
sometimes when you're talking about services that are broad across an industry, then it makes sense to reuse content from other sources and maybe manipulate it, change it to be your own. I think it's harder with copy. I don't know about stealing content. I'm okay with being inspired by other content.
There's malicious stealing.
There's
right?
straight copying, like
of
no
course.
Thought process.
That's
involved.
Not what I'm talking about. But in general, but
inspiration.
Using other content for inspiration, I think, does make a lot of sense. But I think it's hard because you have to follow trends, but you also have to show why you're unique. And I think that's where it's difficult to say easily yes or no in terms of copying content. Because we're trying to tell customers stories when we do digital marketing. And
well, that part is the unique part, obviously, right? But outside of that, did he, or who was it again? Sorry.
Matt Kobach.
Does he do design? Like, is it?
He does everything. Like, he's the head of social at New York Stock Exchange.
I feel like you're sitting on something to say. That's why I want to hear your take on it.
Oh, I think that it's a smart and freeing concept. I think that we all copy one another, particularly in this day and age when we're so connected. It's almost impossible not to seek inspiration from something. But the idea as brands to just do it better, but also don't directly copy your competition is interesting. I also think competition is like an interesting word for a brand. Because there's direct competition, so your direct competitor is doing the exact same thing that you're doing. But then there's competitors that are maybe in the consumer headspace you're trying to go after. So maybe they don't sell the same thing you do, they don't offer the same service you do, but the people that you're trying to target, they also target those people. And to me, that is important to keep an eye on.
Well, and I think I also took from what he said that, you know, you don't even necessarily need to look at a competitive area. You just have to broaden your scope. So sometimes even an area that you don't think is related to you at all might have ideas that you can incorporate into your into your story or into the way you talk about something. Mm-hmm. I can't think of any examples right now, but that's because I just found out about this. So I'm sure if I could do some research, I would do that.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, I tend to not hang out with designers and developers because it's hard for me to say I get inspiration, but like I think of like the Old Spice commercials, right, that we saw that were really fun with the guy on the horse, and then all of a sudden it was Dollar Shave Club. And now everybody tries to do I think it was Target, Ship My Pants, right? Like that type of a sketch
right.
And then we start to see it over and play over
in different industries as well.
So then it becomes, well, is it different that one? But we can couple them all together. So in the broad sense,
yeah,
right, Old Spice, Dollar Shave Club, and Target are in competition but not in competition.
Yeah, well,
you're smiling, so I don't know if I said something stupid.
No, I'm laughing because I've worked on a lot of the projects that you're talking about, and I know some of the backstories. But I think at the end of the day, the consumer headspace is, I think, what you're talking about. Is that those are all competition. It's just they're in different spaces.
Yes.
And I think that I used to work with a creative director. He used to say there are no original ideas. There are just ideas that are done better.
Yes.
And
yes.
So that's kind of what we're talking about and how you do that.
Everything's been done, right? Well, like every song note,
could argue that everything has been done, but you have to figure out, okay, well, is that the original idea? How do you actually qualify that?
The thing that I'm actually pulling in as I'm thinking about this is, I mean, we can look at a company like Apple. They started as a computer company, okay? They were targeting a very specific market. But they eventually grew out into music and everything around music. And they grew out into TV. They have people that are developing car-related things. Like their
health.
Their health. Yeah. You know, they're moving into different areas that is beyond what one would consider their core market.
Well...
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, because they're a purpose-driven company, their mission statement still is valid with all of those additional endeavors. And I'm going to sound really dorky that I know their mission statement, but and I'm not going to say it a word for word, but the thought process is that they're very focused on user experience. It's like to create the best world-class user experience through software, services, et cetera. And so you can look at everything that they're doing, and it still fits in with that mission. So I think that to me is actually indicative of a company being purposeful and understanding what their mission is and making it applicable to multiple different verticals. That's when you win.
So is that where the originality comes from? Because
I love that. That was so insightful.
Thanks.
Go ahead.
You guys want to do your own podcast? It's fine. no, but I'm saying the originality, right? Like I look at Apple now as just that, yes, all of that you said, but like on the consumer side, they're like gateway computers now because Steve Jobs is gone. That's where the originality came. Steve was the original. He was the person that you went to go see the keynotes for, that I would stop everything and watch for the presentation of the iPhone or the new. Mm-hmm. The iPhone was original. Yes, it came off of, if you want to be cynical, at CompUSA in the 90s, the Palm was an attempt at that.
That was more of a hand. It didn't have the phone part, but yes.
So they did what you said. They took an idea and made it better.
Well, but
and Steve Jobs, he just himself, whatever it was about him.
And if you go,
there was something.
And if you go, if you go back in the Genesis a little bit more, the Newton was actually
the
first.
Yes.
And then the Palm came, which was better, more usable and better.
I'm not as old as you, so I didn't know the Newton.
Yeah, shut up.
But I didn't want to. but like you would watch Jobs talk, and I can't point to anything about Steve Jobs that I said to me was like original, other than the fact that he wore the black shirt every day, and then it became folklore that he does it because he doesn't want to waste any time picking out his clothes in the morning because he doesn't have time to waste, which then turned into he's a jerk at the office, and then it turned into everybody else thought you had to be a jerk at the office. It's amazing how what he did without trying to be public about it became philosophy in a lot of Silicon Valley and things of that nature. But yet there was something about it. I don't know what it was. Maybe it was his name, Jobs.
He was,
I don't know.
He was a consummate marketer. And I don't know if you read his autobiography.
I don't really remember. Aggie already knows.
Sorry.
It's okay.
None of his ideas, I mean, kind of circling back, none of his ideas were necessarily original. But they were all, he he looked at how consumers used existing technology and said, I can do this better. And he was able to go to the point to say, I'm not responding to a demand that's there. I'm responding to a demand that I know could be there.
I think it's what he thought should be the plan.
And he had failures too. Like the Cube didn't do very well, even though it was a beautiful computer. It did a lot of things, but it didn't
function with the market. It kind of sucked. But what's amazing is that Apple became a lot of, or considered for a lot of open-minded, liberal-style designers and developers, yet Apple is the exact opposite. They are very much, if you want to put it in political range, like conservative, you do the our way or no way, because PC is actually an open platform. Apple, you work under their constraints in their world. So it's amazing how the balance is that designers all went to Apple and Mac products, and usually designers fall into the stereotype of being a little bit more whatever the word is you want to use. However, you were, because there's the commercial, like, you know, you follow, you're a soldier in the thing. It's very hardcore, but on the marketing side, I had to stay within the dynamics of Apple and iMac products and what programs they approved in the App Store and what, with PC, it's open. But with PC, you have more problems because it is open. So but really, nothing is great and everything is good.
That also ties into Aggie's comment about their mission statement, because they want to control the user experience. And in order to do that, they have to control all facets of it. Not just one or two things and make it open.
It's not necessarily a bad thing. It's just, I think they were very structured, but they got the label of being the freedom for the people, and PC got, I forgot his name completely. Gates, thank you. I said it to myself. Thank you, Lorenzo.
So what was your initial reaction? I mean, you're a brand strategist by training. So what was your, you said that it kind of put a new light on the way you think of things.
The original tweet. It made me start to question what competition means. And the idea that you have, I think that's where I kind of started with this idea that you have direct competitors. And then you have competitors in the consumer headspace. And to me, I then got into this philosophical battle internally of, well, then what's a competitor and what really matters? And then you could argue that, you know, as long as you're going after the same audience or communities, whatever your audience is, that they'd still be considered a competitor. So I went on this huge thing of, well, then where do you seek inspiration? Is it from everything? I think that directly copying a competitor, which is what I think was the essence of that, is where you go wrong. But you can be inspired by all facets of competitors to come up with better work, as long as it suits your mission. And that's where it ties back to where we just went with Apple, purposeful driven brands. It's all about that. So if you find inspiration in someone you could classify as a competitor in the same consumer headspace, as long as you are doing something that accurately represents the heartbeat of whatever you are, then you're doing it right.
Okay, so follow me on this thought process that I'm coming up with in my head now. I'm thinking about how I handle things, and I don't go to competitors' websites ever, because I genuinely, and I don't mean this like in a tough guy way, I genuinely don't care. I don't care what other designers are doing. I don't care. However, I do go to a lot of educators who are my competition, who do provide resources back. So there's a designer who I follow. The company is Blind, they're called, and his name is The Future, or is Chris Doe. He's the one I brought up in a previous podcast.
When we talked about the interviews he did with the designer.
Where he's charging, you know, basically $40,000 for just a logo, right? I go to him because he's an educator, and it's what I tell my clients all the time. I'm like, the best thing you could do is, I don't care if you sell sneakers, hats, food, whatever, is to somehow provide a resource or as an educator back, so that your clients enjoy potentially, but also your competition will look at you if you care about that. Because I literally go to no designer websites, or I don't gain inspiration from anything that I know of tangibly, that I say, let me go to this website to look. I'm sure I get it in other formats, right? Like, I like Gary Vee stuff, so I'll listen to his stuff. My podcast that I listen to, I guess I get it that way audibly, but visually I don't ever. But I think I like competition that provides education, regardless of who they are, rather than, I know clients who like specifically go to like their five biggest competitors and they're like, can you believe they're doing this? And I just think it's not a healthy way to go about it.
Yeah, I can tell you in the experience that I've had, we've developed website programs for multiple, you know, for multiple verticals. And I'm aware of what the competition is doing when a customer brings it up to me. But I don't actively...
Well, they want you to... Because... And that makes sense, right? Like, with doing AdWords, right? I'm doing a bunch of campaigns. And they, not recently, but within the past 6 months, instituted where you can literally just change your cost per click to just be so that you're the top. So whatever the price is, 30, 60 bucks per click, yeah, why not? I mean, I didn't get a text yet, and it's Karen. There we go. So I go to people who, in theory, are my competition, right? Another person who does this. But again, they go, they provide resource, they provide education. So I guess I do look at competition, but I look at it as like someone who I could reach out to and they would charge me a fee to consult rather than, I can't believe this mother effer is doing this or that. Like, it, that seems very like to the streets, like fighting, where it doesn't make, I don't think it's a healthy state of mind.
Well, you're never going to, if you are always looking at your competition, and this is just my take, if you're always looking at your competition and trying to figure out how you're going to beat them, you're never going to look at your own service and figure out where the pitfalls are and where you can improve. I think you always have to come from the, what can I do to make, what business problem am I trying to solve? And does my product or service do that? And if you're not, if you're not looking at it from that perspective and you're only looking at it what your competition is providing, I think the competition almost has to be an afterthought. Like here's I've defined my service. Are there any gaps that I can see from looking at this? Let me look at what the competition is doing just to make sure that, you know, see if there's any good ideas that I can incorporate, but not like I have to get ahead of them, because there's always going to be competition. There's always going to be someone else that's doing something different or better. Or you, I think you just have to look at it from being honest with yourself and making sure that you're doing the best that you can for your customers. And I think being transparent about what you're doing.
And I think that that ties wholeheartedly into being aware and understanding who you are as a company or a brand. So if you're aware of, this is our brand, this is our offering, this is our services, there's always that, well, then what are we trying to do? What is our mission? Once you understand that, yes, you can keep in mind and just keep tabs on what your competition is doing, but it's not the same thing as you. It doesn't matter if they're selling the exact same products. To you, your mission is then what you've dictated as, and it should be unique because it's yours.
Right.
I think on the big side, like Wendy's versus McDonald's, right?
Sure.
Wendy's is brilliant at doing this with their trolling of McDonald's.
Oh my God.
Fun with it.
Hilarious.
And McDonald's has actually seemed to, from public, right, seems to now realize that, yes, that's actually kind of fun and you should do it back, right? There's the Wendy's where you pulled into the parking lot and then it gave, it told you, okay, drive to the McDonald's around the corner to get your reward points to come back here.
I think, like, that was actually a Burger King McDonald's.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But they're all trolling each other, as they say, the kids. That kind of competition, of course, they're looking at it right now because was it Wendy's or Burger King has the non meat burger, the Impossible Burger out there. Who does the Whopper?
Burger King.
Burger King.
Burger King. Yes, so they have the Impossible King. Burger, right?
Yep. Right.
I mean, we all know that the other ones are going to do get
plant
competition
protein
of the Impossible Burger, right? And it becomes a thing. So that kind of stuff makes sense, right? The retail side, the Target, the Bed Bath & Beyond, of course. But for us in the streets, I don't have to, I mean, I guess I have to sleep less so I can look at my competition. Right? Is that how it works? Is that how it works? But you, Miss Creative, former agency, what, I'm sure you saw some pretty nasty stuff with mid-level agencies to high-level agencies, because they come out with a campaign and it becomes news within that world, right? Not for us small fry, but agency stuff. Did you, do you remember seeing a campaign coming out from a competitor that said, wow, that's pretty good, or wow,
oh,
it kind of ripped us off, or?
Both. Yeah. I think that, you know, when you're in deep with a creative idea to live within a campaign, You do have to understand what the competition is doing, because it is something that's important as you're ideating when things are kind of still squishy. When you actually execute and you see afterwards, you know, it does become news, and then you see, oh my gosh, we did something that was similar to someone else, or vice versa. It is something that can feel really like insular and polarizing when you're like inside
that
space.
So you have to be aware of that stuff.
You have to be. Right? But I think that at the end of the day, and this is where it always comes back to, if you understand the brand that you're working on and you understand what it's trying to do, the ideas will always be unique to that, even if they in some way were inspiration derived from competitors in the same consumer headspace. I don't mean directly copying, because that's like no bueno. But if you're deriving inspiration, it's cool to do that. But I did see, and I did have, you know, friends who would get upset, like, that was totally our campaign idea. Oh my God, can you see them doing that? And I think at the end of the day, you're just like, yeah, but they didn't do it as well. So
what about the problem is sometimes is when the brand themselves don't know who they are or think they're something else.
Yes.
And I met with a client the other day, and I told him directly, I said, you're too romantic about your business. Mm-hmm. When they come through the door, you might have the best product. But you have to understand that not everybody, it's not their business. So he was under the, you know, he's under the belief that you try our product, it's the best in the world. I get it. But he was, I kept telling him, like, you're too romantic about it, because you have to understand that people who don't know who your stuff is may go somewhere else, and they may like it somewhere else. So sometimes it's challenging to teach the brand themselves.
Oh, yeah. Well, brand strategy and the idea of developing just brand guidelines, and that's a daunting task. And it's a incredibly strategic task. And I find that a lot of companies sometimes like to skip that step because, oh, no, we know who we are. But when you actually are in deep, you find out, well, you don't really know how to articulate who you are. And even if you know who you are, we're the best. This is what we're trying to do. Understanding what your reasons to believe, which are, you know, code for how do you know and how, what are your proof points? That is the piece that needs to be done in order to develop that. And having that in place is what allows you to then say, no, this is actually who we are. This is our mission. And this is why it's true. So when you do go out to the marketplace, you can then articulate it to your target audience. But without that piece, you're just kind of guessing.
I would even argue that as you're a growing company, you need to be able to articulate that to the people that work for you too.
100%. Talking about brands and them understanding, you know, who they are, and maybe it being a little bit fantastical is what I think you were kind of getting to. I've been in situations where everyone in the same company has a different version of the brand story. Mm-hmm. That can be dicey. Because if you're going out into the marketplace, do we all rally around the same thing? Do we all know what we're trying to do? And if you don't have that in place, it can be a bad situation, because it can be bad from the way that you sell, because then everyone's selling it differently. It can be bad from a consistency standpoint, because then your brand is looking all over the place, but also for morale. If you think that the company is, this is why I'm with this company, and your boss is like, no, actually, that is totally off. Well, you need to make sure that it's being driven from, you know, the top down, and everyone has the same verbiage being used. It's important, I think, for internal morale, as well as making sure that you're articulating it to your future customers.
That is, and even that, sometimes when they have that challenge, I'll ask them, who are they marketing to? Because I've had clients, because I deal on a smaller scale, and if I spoke the way you did now to some of the small, they'd be like, what story? Like, but then you start telling them, when I say your story, to them it seems too formal, right?
Sure.
On a large scale, it's needed. I get it. Because just for the fact of there's so many people.
So many people involved.
But I asked them, you know, who are you marketing to?
Right.
And it's funny, especially when it's like a husband and wife. It's just to see this. And coming from the wedding industry, dealing with the young version of what they may become later, just to see how the facial reactions are when one, whether the wife says something and the husband, you could see that they are in it together, but they're not going down the same road of what it feels like, because usually one is doing one part and one is doing the other part. Mm-hmm. And when I talk to them about, well, who's your target client? The easier answer is always, oh, it's everybody, right? Of course, it's everybody.
And it's the easy way out.
If you're selling hoodies, maybe it's close to everybody, but not everybody. Like, you're not my dad. My dad's not your target client. Right? So it's not really everybody. And I try to say to them, it's not so much that I need you to write down your message. Like, I don't need you to, if you're not like that, you don't need to. But what I need to understand is, tell me your client's message. Tell me what your client is looking for. Because then they start to see a pattern of, well, my client is a 34-year-old female who is working and has two kids and is a single mom.
Right.
And then all of a sudden, it's like, well, okay, so how did you get to that? Like, it's therapy. Yeah. And it becomes, they don't realize it because they cover it with the paint of business, but usually it's an indication of them individually, whether they are aware of themselves.
Mm-hmm. Understanding your target audience.
On the micro level.
Well, but I think that micro, macro, I think sometimes, you know, to your point, I do use words that are maybe more applicable to a bigger brand. However, like the idea of understanding your target audience, I think is true and valid, whether you're a business of one or you have a bigger company. And what you're saying is that they need to understand who their audience is that they're going after and be able to understand who they are. Then once you do understand who your brand is and you understand who you're going after, well, then you can figure out what's important to that target audience and then have a killer message. And it's all about targeting.
Yes. You know why I think I have those experiences? Because I used to get 3 out of 5 that were basically a year into their business at most, or starting out new, or any of that stuff. And sometimes on the larger scale, the companies that you may have experienced in the past were established for 10, 5, 7,
Fair.
12 years. And they have a less granular feeling
Sure.
towards the streets.
Right.
So when you say messaging and stuff like that to them, it's like, yeah, I know we have to do it. And they have, like, 10
Right.
of them. Whereas I say it to someone who wants to be a personal chef, they're like, and I'm, you know, it doesn't relate to them. So I think it just experiences in the past. So it almost feels like, I think you're more closer to this side now, right? And you were for freelance, when you freelance too. Mm-hmm. Mariana?
I need to digest that a little while.
Do you want to wait till the next episode? Because we're almost done.
Yeah, I think I may wait until the next episode. The only thing that I'll leave with is that I can understand your point, but I think the people that understand why they're doing what they're doing and what they're trying to solve from the outset and are able to articulate that, like Aggie had said earlier,
yeah.
have
yeah.
an easier time convincing other people that this is the product for them,
but that's,
or service for
them.
But
isn't that life? Like when you're just more self-aware, confident, whatever those words are, whether you translate it into your individual or business, right? For one reason or another, I know that we probably have enough experience that we can meet an individual not knowing anything about them, talking to them in 10 minutes and figuring out if they're made to run a business or not. Typically.
I would say that's true.
Right? And I don't mean run a business as in they have a partner and the partner runs the business, but they're the talent and they think they're running the business. I'm saying run the business, like the janitor to the CEO and everything in between, whether you start out by yourself or have 15 people to mm-hmm. be the type A personality, right? To do that. I do stuff with Aggie, and before I even blink, she's already in Trello marking stuff up for me. So like, it's a no-brainer over there, right? She might be 5'1", but it doesn't matter. She's 7 foot with attitude, so it's good. But then there are others that you, and I think the businesses are an indication of the person. Company names aside.
All right, screaming lunatic.
Yeah, or rock star.
I was not. I was thinking screaming lunatic too.
Okay, yeah, I know you were. I've set you up. Did you digest, or you want to wait?
I digested. I'm. But I'm not. I'm not going to prolong this podcast right now. I'll have other ideas later.
Okay, get back to us at episode 151. Episode 150. It's in the can. Thank you, and share it somewhere. Aggie loves Twitter. Bye.